A survey asked this question, is man basically good?
The overwhelming majority of professing evangelicals answered in the affirmative, that you may have sin on the peripheral elements of your life that affect you outwardly, but in your heart of hearts, scratch beneath the surface, and you will find an abiding goodness.
So how would you answer that question? Your answer will determine how you view sin, Jesus' work on the cross, how you and I are saved, and God's sovereignty. In other words, today's lesson from Dr. R.C. Sproul covers some extremely important ground. So let's join him now with a message titled, Are We Born Free?
We have seen already one part of the two-front war that is engaged with respect to the issue of free will, namely, how free will relates to divine sovereignty. And of course, that subject in and of itself is worthy of an entire series because there are so many issues involved in it. But what I want to concentrate on in this series is the crisis with respect to the other front of the war, namely with respect to the doctrine of original sin as it relates to the question of free will. Now, that issue emerged in great controversy in the early church with the influence of a man by the name of Pelagius. And so, because of his name, we refer to this as the Pelagian controversy. That pitted Pelagius and his associates, Celestus and Julian, against the titan of the church in the first millennium, Saint Augustine. Now, this controversy broke out towards the end of the 4th century and carried over into the 5th century, and finally was settled at the Council of Carthage in 418, in which council Pelagius was condemned by the church as a heretic. Now, as often is the case in the history of heretics and church decisions and decrees of that matter, just because the church declares a theological position heretical and renounces it does not mean it just simply goes away and disappears once and for all. I would venture to say that the Pelagian error is one of the most difficult errors that constantly confronts the church, and certainly even in our own day. Well, let's step back from it for a second and ask the question, what was the Pelagian controversy all about? Well, to look at that first, we have to understand a little bit of the biographical background of Pelagius. Pelagius, according to tradition, was born in Ireland, making him one of my national ancestors. And Pelagius was certainly British. He was from the British Isles. And he was an earnest and zealous monk who traveled to Rome and lived in Rome and was very much exercised by the cavalier spirit that he found among the clergy and among Christians in the eternal city. And in fact, he was appalled by the licentiousness, the godlessness, and the conduct of those who were claiming to be Christians. And he was a zealot for the achieving of righteousness. In that regard, Pelagius had something in common with the original Pharisees. Now, when we use the term Pharisee, we usually use it in a pejorative sense. We have a negative connotation of the Pharisees because it was the Pharisees who were always so hostile towards Jesus. But that wasn't the first generation of Pharisees. The original Pharisees were the Puritans of their day, men who loved the covenant of God, men who loved the law of God, and who were very much concerned about the moral laxity that had invaded the community of Israel. And so what the Pharisees devoted themselves to was to separate themselves unto the pursuit of righteousness through obedience to the law of God. So their motives were originally to restore the covenant truth and the law to Israel. And then, of course, they became self-righteous and disintegrated into the enemies of Christ that they were when we meet them in the pages of the New Testament. Well, if we look at Pelagius, we see that Pelagius had this zeal for godliness and for righteousness and was very much concerned and exercised about the moral laxity that he found in the church at the end of the 4th century. And then what provoked him to the theological controversy that bears his name was a response to a famous prayer that had been penned by the Bishop of Hippo, Saint Augustine. Augustine had, in his prayer, made this statement: O God, grant what thou commandest, and command what thou dost desire. Let me say it again. O God, grant what thou commandest, and command what thou dost desire. Now, how do you respond to such a prayer? Most of us would respond warmly and positively to such a prayer as that, but not Pelagius. Pelagius about had apoplexy when he read that prayer. Now, he was in complete agreement with the second part of the prayer, wherein Augustine had said to God, God, command whatsoever thou dost desire. Now, obviously, Augustine wasn't assuming that he was giving God permission to command whatever God desires, but rather he was simply acquiescing and acknowledging his willingness to submit to God's law, whatever God desired that law to be. And that was the intent of the sentiment of the second part of the prayer, with which Pelagius had no problems and made no objection. It was the first part of the prayer that upset him so greatly, when he heard Augustine say, O God, grant what thou dost command. Well, you say, why would you pray a prayer like that? If God commands it, surely he doesn't have to grant you the power or the authority to do whatever he commands. Augustine, of course, was saying, God, give me a gift. Help me. What Augustine was talking about here was grace. When he says, God, grant what thou dost command, he was saying, God, give me the grace to be able to do what you command. Because Augustine believed, as we will see when we study him, that man is unable to obey the commandments of God unless God grants the necessary grace to do it. And here's where Pelagius objected. He said, no. Whatever God commands imposes an obligation and responsibility on the creature to obey it. And the first article of our theology has to do with the doctrine of God, according to Pelagius. And Pelagius said the thing that we understand so clearly about God is that God is just. And being just, God would never, and indeed could never, command his creature to do something that the creature is unable to do. For God to command us to do something we are not able to do would be to impose an unjust commandment upon us, and even worse, to punish us when we fail to do what we couldn't possibly do in the first place would be diabolical. It would be like God said to us, fly unaided, without any machines or equipment, from Orlando to Chicago. And God held us accountable for that when He hasn't given us wings or feathers or any other equipment to make the soaring journey through the air. And so the idea that man required grace or some kind of divine assistance to do his duty was utterly repugnant to Pelagius, because, again, he said, this casts a shadow on the righteousness of God. Now, Augustine, of course, would respond to that and would say, wait a minute, man cannot obey the law of God without the help of grace because man is fallen. And the effects of the fall involve, to some degree or extent, the loss of our moral power. Now, God's law doesn't change. In creation, God said, be holy, even as I am holy. You shall be perfect, even as I am perfect. But most of us would recognize today that the ability to be perfectly holy, perfectly mirroring the righteousness of God, is an ability we don't have. Adam had it in creation, but Adam fell. And with Adam's fall, the entire race fell with him, and the fall meant a fall into a state of corruption by which we are born with a sin nature such that we no longer are morally able to obey the law of God perfectly. Hence, we need grace. So what was assumed by Augustine here was the reality of the fall. In light of the fall, Augustine was arguing, we need grace in order to obey God. So now the dispute turned into a controversy over the fall and its effects. Now, of course, Pelagius did not deny that Adam sinned. What he said is that Adam was created good, and in his creation, he was made immutably good with respect to his constituent nature. Now, that means that, according to Pelagius, man was created good, but he had the freedom or the power to obey or disobey, to do good or to do evil. But even when he chose to do evil, and that was real sin, that choice did not change his nature. So that today, every human being who is born into this world is born in the same moral condition that Adam was created prior to the fall. So what Pelagius is denying is not that Adam sinned, but that Adam fell in the sense of plunging himself and his descendants into a state of moral corruption by which their natures were changed. Historically, we would say that we are sinners not because we sin, but we sin because we are sinners. That is, that we are born with a sin nature. That's the point that was so sharply in dispute with Pelagius. So for Pelagius, man always has the ability to do either good or evil. He has not lost the moral ability or the moral power to obey God. Sin affects him, but not at the core. Now, you remember in our last session I talked about the Gallup poll, where the majority of professing evangelicals that were polled in response to the question, do you believe that man is basically good, that is, good at the core, the overwhelming majority of professing evangelicals answered in the affirmative. That's the Pelagian answer. The answer is that you may have sin on the peripheral elements of your life that affect you outwardly, but in your heart of hearts, in the deepest part of your soul, scratch beneath the surface, and you will find an abiding, immutable goodness to the human heart. And that, of course, was the position of Pelagius. Now, again, for Pelagius, though Adam fell, his fall affected Adam and only Adam. There was nothing that was passed on to his descendants, no transfer or imputation of guilt, or no corruption of nature that resulted from Adam's sin. In a sense, no fall. There was the failure of Adam, but no consequences to Adam or anyone else as far as the power of our will and the power of our nature. What Pelagius went on to say was that he was not opposed to grace. He understood that the Bible has much to say about grace, and that grace is a good thing, not a bad thing, and there's nothing wrong with praying for grace. But for Pelagius, grace, the operative word, is facilitates obedience or righteousness. That is to say, with the help of grace, it is easier to live a life of moral perfection, to be totally obedient to the law of God. But it's not necessary. It helps, it facilitates it, but it's not something that is required. Again, why is he saying that? He is saying if grace is necessary in order to be righteous, then the person who is not righteous without the aid of grace is no longer accountable or morally culpable for having sinned because he couldn't do anything but sin. Pelagius is incarnating the response of the clay to the potter, "Why hast thou made me thus?" And objecting to any fall concept that would make it necessary for grace in order to be righteous. In fact, he not only says that grace facilitates righteousness, but is not necessary for righteousness. He went on to argue that some people, indeed many people, not only can live perfect lives, but that many, in fact, have without the benefit of grace. Over against that, Augustine had declared his view that the human race was a mass of perdition, and that not only did no one ever live a perfect life, but no one ever really did an absolutely good deed, that our best deeds are, at the very best, what Augustine called splendid vices. We recall, of course, the teaching of the Apostle Paul in Romans 3, there is none righteous, no, not one. There is none who does good, no, not one. Over against that, Pelagius is saying, many are righteous, yes, many. Many do good, yes, indeed, many. In direct opposition to the clear teaching of the New Testament. Now, what is at stake here with the Pelagian attack is not just the idea of the necessity of grace, but the whole concept of our salvation, the whole understanding of what is going on in the drama of salvation, since God's grace is now just a concluding, unscientific postscript that is not something that is absolutely essential in order for us to be saved. and it paves the way for the resurgence of neo-nomianism or pure legalism, where a person can be righteous in and of themselves. This is what we call self-righteousness, a righteousness that is accomplished and achieved by our own natural powers without the assistance of grace. And this even casts a shadow on what Christ has done for his people. In terms of the supreme work of God's grace is in giving us a Redeemer who lives a life of perfect righteousness in our place, upon the basis of whose righteousness those who believe are declared just in the sight of God. For Pelagius, we are not justified on the grounds of the imputation of the righteousness of Christ. We are justified on the grounds of what? Our own righteousness that we achieve by exercising our free will. And as this issue began to heat up, Pelagius even went so far as to teach that the chief way in which Christ works in behalf of our redemption is by providing us with a stellar example of moral perfection. I mean, we've seen this appear many, many times in church history where the atonement is gutted and replaced by some kind of influence theory by which Jesus saves us by setting a good example and by being a moral influence by showing us the right way to achieve righteousness. Augustine saw this as an attack not simply on a minor point or a simple detail of Christian theology, but something that touches the very heart of our whole concept of salvation and redemption. Because before we can be saved, we first have to understand our absolute need for salvation and our impoverished condition to understand that we are debtors who cannot pay our debts. Again, for Pelagius, no one's in debt. And even if they were in debt, they had it within themselves to pay their debt. This is the ultimate bootstrap theology by which people earn their way or merit their way into the kingdom of God. And so Augustine saw this as a stake in the heart of grace, a stake in the heart of the biblical concept of salvation. And as Adolf von Harnack, the great German church historian, has said, this controversy was waged in the most clear terms of any theological controversy in church history, with the possible exception of the Arian controversy that culminated in the Council of Nicaea. But that this dispute here was a dispute in which both parties clearly understood what the other side was saying, and that there was no studied ambiguity that was involved in the discussion. The question is grace an absolute prerequisite for salvation, or is it simply an aid?
It all boils down to an understanding of ourselves. Are we good enough to choose God, or do we need God to change our hearts? Dr. R.C. Sproul has taken us back to the first major debate in the church over man's free will. Where we land in this debate determines what we think about God and salvation, so it's important that we get this right. This week on Renewing Your Mind, we're airing portions of R.C.'s series, Willing to Believe. If you'd like to have a biblical perspective on this topic, let me commend this series to you. We'll send it to you on 3 DVDs when you contact us today with your donation of any amount. Our number is 800-435-4343, but you can also go online and give your gift at renewingyourmind.org. Let me remind you that our Bible Study magazine also probes important theological issues. If you'd like to learn more about free will, God's sovereignty, man's depravity, and other topics, let me recommend Table Talk magazine. When you subscribe, you'll have access to articles from today's leading theologians, plus you'll find daily guided Bible studies. You can explore some articles online and learn how to subscribe at tabletalkmagazine.com. Well, tomorrow, Dr. Sproul will continue the series, Willing to Believe. He'll address this question: how can God hold us responsible for being a sinner when it's our nature to sin?
Isn't that the dilemma? Here we have God holding people morally accountable to a standard of righteousness they cannot possibly attain or achieve. And it seems at first blush to be manifestly unfair.
We hope you'll join us Thursday for Renewing Your Mind.